If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I also think I've done a really good job of trying to ask questions in different ways and see if the story corroborates. And that's not just asking the sponsor the questions, but asking maybe past investors from that sponsor or even some service providers that are working with the sponsor. You know, I think I've done a pretty good job of, just digging around people's backgrounds, digging around people's reputations and that kind of thing.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sam.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to have you on. If you don't mind, can you give our listeners just a quick bio on yourself?
Sure. I am a mechanical engineer, I guess, by education. And our family, we own some manufacturing businesses here in Michigan. So I am involved in the leadership of those manufacturing companies. But the past few years, and part of the reason that we connected, the past few years, I've been kind of more focused on diversifying, I guess, our portfolio and doing quite a bit of real estate investing. And you might call it passive or alternative investing, you know, kind of things.
That's super cool. That's super cool. So you guys are active both in business then, and but also in the passive side of real estate investing.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Like I'm sitting here at our main manufacturing company, which is called Orbit Form. And I'm not heavily involved in the day-to-day operations, but yeah, just past this wall here, there's a bunch of really smart engineers. And then past two walls, there's a factory and we're cutting, bending, welding, grinding, painting, building machines, you know, out in the factory.
Man, that's super cool. Now, have you guys also, you've also had your hands in some active real estate deals as well.
So we own several industrial buildings. And so that's my main hands-on direct real estate ownership experience, you know, along with some, I guess, single family houses and, like vacation kind of properties. But mostly industrial.
Gotcha. Now, yeah, we could take this so many different directions today. I'm excited to jump in. You know, I think one of the things that's fascinating is that real estate is often, you know, people overlook the fact that real estate is a business. And so I really want to hear from your perspective how we as real estate investors can take a more measured approach to our business side of real estate investing. Can you talk to us a little bit about that front and how those two interplay?
Well, I mean, you're right. That can go a lot of different directions, but I guess in real estate is a business. And so it's probably pretty important to establish your goals and your expectations so that when you look at your monthly expenses and your performance, you can kind of say, wow, you know, this sure didn't fall in line with what I expected. And, you know, I mean, building your pro formas, you know, researching the prior expenses and the prior rents and the market information. I mean, I guess all that stuff is applicable to whether you're pricing a machine or pricing food and restaurant or pricing your rent and your reimbursements and your, you know, real estate operation. It's probably a lot of shared.
Right. How did you guys get involved in the industrial side of things?
Well, just by having a manufacturing business, we had to have a building. And so this is before I was too cognizant of what was going on, but, you know, maybe in the 80s, 1980s, you know, my father, you know, was starting the business and, you know, you got to have a building to operate in. And so him and his original partners, instead of renting, they bought some buildings and so now we own them. Our family owns those, you know, directly.
Gotcha. Now, are you guys still using those as manufacturing facilities or do you lease those out?
Both. We have, three buildings in total. Two of them we have our own operations inside of, and the third we have a tenant. The third one happens to be in a different state where we used to have operations, but we closed that business and now we have a tenant that occupies it.
Gotcha. So you closed the business but held on to the real estate.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Right. Walk us through that. I mean, what was it like to shut down a business and then you know, come up with a plan to still retain, you know, the real estate as an asset?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that it was the plan. Basically, we, you know, we bought a business in Connecticut. And after a couple of years, this is in probably the late 90s. And then after a few years, it really started struggling. Mm. And so we ended up, you know, basically we ended up selling off parts of the business and then closing it at the end. And we're actually very fortunate because we're in a, you know, Connecticut isn't necessarily a booming industrial area, but we're very fortunate that we have a neighbor that has had some growth. And so our next door neighbor actually leases our building. So it's really great to have a tenant whose headquarters is next door. And our space is like, you talk about location being key. Like, you know, they couldn't find a better location. So we're very fortunate that they rent from us in that market.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now that's interesting. What was the timeline between when you guys shut that business and then when you had it, you know, leased back out?
It must've been 6 to 9 months. So it wasn't, it was, you know, this is back in 2009. So, you know, everything was harrowing, you know, it was harrowing for everybody in 2008 and nine. So that was when this kind of all transpired. And since then, we've had 10 or 11 years now of solid relationship with our tenant.
Right. And I bet that's a pretty cool building to own. One, because industrial obviously is hot right now, you know, but then secondly, you know, you have an asset. I mean, is there any plans to ever dispose of it or is it just hold it indefinitely?
Well, I don't know how deep you want to get here, but it's kind of like a extremely environmentally challenged property.
Right.
And so there's a whole bunch to talk about there, but we don't want to get into that. So again, we're very fortunate and very blessed because I'm not sure it's going to be very sellable, to be honest with you, because I'm not sure if you are familiar with this, but sometimes when you trade properties, the seller indemnifies the buyer from certain levels of risk.
Right.
So we currently are indemnified from another party. But if we're not the controlling owner of this building, we lose that indemnification. So it's kind of tricky. I'm not sure that will ever sell this property.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, that's something that people have to think about, especially as it pertains to industrial properties. I'm no expert on this, but certainly have been privy to enough phase studies and things like that to know that if it won't pass the test, then the marketability of it is almost nil. So
I would say that lack of experience on my dad's part in the 90s has greatly increased our level of scrutiny on any other real estate acquisitions we've made since then.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are lessons you learn and it doesn't take too many times to learn that lesson. And you say, okay, we're not going to do that again, but it sounds like so far so good, you know, for you guys. So good for you. That's fantastic. So you've grown, you own manufacturing businesses, you've got industrial, some industrial investments. What are you passively investing in right now?
Well, since 2016 is kind of when this kind of ball got rolling on some of these passive investments. And I'd say there's been quite a few different endeavors, but probably the ones that have stuck are multifamily apartment buildings and mobile home parks and automated teller machines. Those are kind of the three asset classes that I guess, you know, we've continued to reinvest in over time, you know, so 5, 10, 15 different investments over, you know, in multi-years. And so continuing to invest in those arenas.
Right. What have you seen? So you began passively investing in 2016, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So in across, I think you told me offline, maybe about 30 different opportunities, between those. What have you seen change in the offering structures and kind of the terms on deals over the last 5 years?
Well, the area that I think I have the most insight in is the mobile home park space. And it's just been fascinating to, I mean, 2017, when I first got introduced to the space, I didn't have any personal connections who knew anything about it or wanted to talk about it. And then I'm sure if you tracked it on a curve, you know, the number of people who have made passive investments in the mobile home park space since 2017, it's probably a pretty steep incline. And so it's just been interesting to kind of see all the new syndicators kind of enter the market and all the people who are trying to get parks under contract and all the people that are asking questions about how to get in deals. And all the podcasts that have been released on the topic. And when it comes to the deal terms, I guess, again, I'm not trying to say I'm an expert, but I've seen the prefs and the splits, you know, and the cap rates, you know, really change. The prefs and splits moving towards the general partners kind of advantage a little bit. And then the cap rates, obviously, you know, compressing for sure, even in this 4 or 5 year timeframe.
Right. No, that's interesting. Have you seen, well, I guess the interest in the space, you know, you have way more knowledge on the mobile home park space than I do, because I've invested in exactly zero of them. So, you know, don't discount what you know, but I think it's curious how you mentioned that the prefs have changed and that the terms have become more favored towards the GP. Why do you think that is?
I think it's at the highest level, not only is there a lot of demand, supply demand has a lot of different factors involved in the mobile home park space. The first is, why would you want to invest in the space? Well, there's tons of demand for affordable housing. Mobile home parks are some of the most affordable housing, and there's zero supply or maybe negative supply of mobile home park spaces. So that's interesting. And then supply demand also relates to the investors. There's more demand from investors to get in the space. So that's where the cap rates, you know, kind of start compressing. And then because there's more interest from passive investors, specifically the operators of these parks and the, you know, the syndicators and the operators become the constraint. So to me, the constraint to the mobile home park investing space is quality operators. And so they've just been able to gather more proportion of the deal because, you know, you can't just go around next door and hire a third party property manager for your mobile home park. So like in multifamily, I mean, you can buy a place cross country and you can hire a third party property manager and you can probably do okay with your multifamily project. But in mobile home park space, there just isn't that supply of third party property managers to hire. So the operator who takes the deal down and runs it and is really critical.
Yeah, and I've heard that. I was actually speaking with a well-known mobile home park investor here. Gosh, it'd been now a year ago, feels like yesterday, but a year ago about that. And they had hired a third-party management company, and it only lasted 6 to 9 months. And the wheels, I mean, the whole thing just fell apart. They said, man, we had to take everything we own back in-house and, you know, clean up the mess because it's just not available. So that's a really interesting thing you point out there, is that you have to have a quality operator in that space. As you've gone through 30 passive syndications, that's a lot. That's a lot of different investments. Have you had any that have not worked out as planned? And then what did you do about it?
So far, I've only had a couple that have kind of, you know, blown up, you'd say. What have I done about it? I'm trying to think from, well, one of them is in the multifamily space. And I think I didn't do a good enough job of understanding the, and I didn't understand the difference between a syndicator and an experienced operator. You know, back in 2017, 2018, I just hadn't been through enough reps. And so now I try to figure out, okay, is this person raising money and buying a property, or does this person have experience running properties? Mm-hmm. And there's a huge difference, obviously. So I invested in a deal in Houston, and basically the syndicator wasn't very experienced operating. And so I didn't have that as a very strong filter before going in. So now I really want to understand how much do I have confidence in their operations experience and performance.
Right, right. Yeah, I've heard that said a dozen times, but you know, you'd much rather have a B deal with an A team operator than an A deal with a, you know, B team operator.
Sure.
What did that deal just fall apart entirely and, you know, it just closed up and you lost, or is there any pulling up from that?
No. So that deal had a couple kind of, how do you say it? Had a couple co-GPs who mm-hmm. signed on the recourse. And fortunately, those co-GPs who didn't want to really be hands-on have the ability and the financial interest to kind of take over. And so the original managing general partner is no longer hands-on. He still has an investment, but he's no longer calling the shots. Right. And two of the co-GPs who signed recourse and did a lot to help the deal get constructed have gotten much more hands-on. So we haven't had distribution for 9 or 12 months, but I do feel confident that at minimum, they're going to keep it running and be able to sell it at some point. But it's just, it probably isn't going to hit the performance metrics that we all were hoping for. But it's not a train wreck. It's just getting back on the track.
Right. And that's an interesting point you brought up there, in that I think, you know, one of the questions I have, because I've got passive investments around the country too, and I ask this question directly to some of the sponsors: how do I fire you? Mm-hmm. And I mean that. I mean mm-hmm. that as harshly yeah. and as gently as I can. If you suck, how do I fire you? And it, to your point, you guys, and I have never seen that happen. And usually these are friends of mine. So I mean, it's kind of, you know, use that tongue in cheek. But at the same time, I want to see in the documents what yeah. things you have to do wrong for us to remove you as the manager and bring somebody else in. So it sounds like you've kind of gone through that.
Yeah, I think I was lucky that there were some fairly sophisticated and experienced investors in the deal. So the operating agreement was written as such, where these co-GPs, without even getting the limited partners involved, these co-GPs could remove the managing GP. So I had nothing to do with that. I wasn't smart enough to look for that or even consider it, but I'm just fortunate that those guys care enough and they have language that they can execute that.
Yeah, no, that's a real blessing. And again, that goes back to, you know, the thing we talked about earlier is having the A-class operators there on the team to make sure those things get done. So good for you. Cause yeah, I mean, the next step is for the LPs to come in, and that it just gets really messy.
Sure.
So let's try to avoid that. That's really great. What are some things that you feel like you've done right as you have invested in real estate?
I think I've done a good job of getting out and shaking hands and meeting the people that we've invested with. I think I've done a really good job of, you know, sitting across the table, talking face to face, breaking bread, meeting families, touring properties like in person. Mm-hmm. And then I also think I've done a really good job of trying to ask questions in different ways and see if the story corroborates. And that's not just asking the sponsor the questions, but asking maybe past investors from that sponsor or even some service providers that are working with the sponsor. So, you know, I think I've done a pretty good job of, just digging around people's backgrounds, digging around people's reputations and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's brilliant. I forget who it was I was talking to recently, but he was a big, well-known developer. And he goes, I can't believe that more people, you know, they're writing $500,000 checks, but they're not spending $500 on a plane ticket and a day of their time to come out and visit these job sites. He goes, that blows my mind. He goes, everybody's welcome. Always come see what we're doing. But sure. People aren't doing what you're doing, which is I think really, really smart. That's super cool. You told me about a deal that you guys had, and I'd love to hear this story before we jump into the final four. But a deal where you were able to acquire the business and the real estate, and you made it really work out well for the seller and for you. Do you mind sharing that story?
Yeah, I think you had a podcast interview recently that made me recall an experience, and I shared it with you. Again, believe me, I'm not trying to brag here or anything. Just there was a fairly local manufacturing business that the sellers, you know, that was for sale, mm-hmm. and we entered into a discussion to buy it. And to make a long story short, they wanted to sell the building and the real estate together. They wanted to wipe their hands clean. And so basically I was able to negotiate the business deal that worked for both parties. And I was, you know, it was a fair deal. And then I was kind of able to kind of act like I didn't really want the building. And it ended up happening as we were able to get a really, really nice high cap rate on the building and buy it for, you know, like way below the appraisal that came in. And so the building has been has cash flowed very well for the past few years, and we're the tenant. So it's like our operating company is tenant to the building, and the building was purchased at a very nice, attractive price.
So you bought those two separately, the building and the business, because the business you could have relocated?
Well, I guess we could have, but that was never the intention.
Right.
Just kind of was able to use some leverage that they wanted to do both at one time to get maybe a little better deal on the building.
Right. Right. No, I think that's great. That's brilliant. Cause those are things that I think, you know, for the rest of us who are strictly real estate related, we oftentimes forget. I own businesses in multiple categories. And so you forget to look that maybe there's a business here you could buy and run as well as the real estate play.
And I think also, as always happens in any kind of deal, there's always underlying motivations. And if you can learn the underlying motivations above and beyond dollars, sometimes it can be better for everybody involved. And, you know, this one happened to be, I think, was better for the buyer, which was us, you know, so we were fortunate in that transaction.
Yeah, but it also sounds like the seller needed an exit that was clean, and, you know, you provided that for him. So I think your point there is right. The terms are often better than maybe necessarily the final dollar sign. That's super cool. Sure. That's super cool. David, let's jump here into the final four if we can. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
There's this term, I think it's in the Japanese culture, of go see. And you go and see, like go out and see things. And I think that applies to the people you're doing business with. It applies to the property you're considering investing in. It applies to the neighborhood. It applies to the surrounding, you know, market. I mean, everything. Like someone's offering you investment and you've never been to that state or been to that location. If you can, go see.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. What is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
Probably just continually reaching out and talking to people like yourself and other investors. And just, I feel like every day I'm fortunate to be able to have a couple discussions with different professionals. And sometimes I'm the one who's sharing my experience and sometimes they're sharing theirs. And hopefully at the end, we all get better.
Sure. No, that's great. That's great. When it comes to giving back, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
Well, I'm a youth sports coach for my daughters. And I'm on the school board for our school. And I guess I'm a trustee with our church and, you know, just try to be involved in civic organizations, you know, and that kind of thing. This might also another little tidbit. Again, I mean, we're very fortunate that we have some of these businesses and our families, you know, is doing okay. And so we have this thing where every year we say, okay, 80% of our profits, we're going to reinvest, 10% we're going to enjoy, and 10% we're going to donate. And so me and my siblings, you know, kind of talk about, okay, that 10% to donate, what do we want to do with that? And so that's our meeting coming up around Easter to define our 2020, I guess, 10% donation. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah. Oh man, how much fun is that? I bet that's a good, a pleasurable discussion when it comes to work. That's very cool. David, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, they can email me, dshirky@orbitform.com. And they can email me and get hold of me, or they can find me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to connect.
Awesome. David, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.